started here. So I just want to welcome everybody. Thank you for joining our Parent Power Collab. Our Parent Power Group. Really, what we're our focus for this group is to allow parents to come, listen, feel comfortable in this space, knowing that our focus is to empower parents, give them any knowledge that they can to help them, guide them, be a support for them. We're also happy if parents want to share ideas that have worked for them or share their concerns or questions related to the topic. So we're always open for that. Just to give a little background, I'm Adina Frankel, the co-owner and clinical manager of Mastermind Behavior Services. We provide top-notch ABA services to children on the spectrum. So our focus really is to provide excellence and support to the child and family. I want to take this opportunity to invite and thank Dr. Amber Perryman-Evans for joining us here to give us insight on the topic of dealing with a diagnosis. This is a moderated format, so it's going to be kind of a question answer just to make it simpler and easier to understand and to hear the gamut of what we want to discuss as far as dealing with a diagnosis goes. So Dr. Perryman-Evans, if it's okay, if I ask you a question just to get us started.
Sure.
Okay. So as far as a diagnosis, right, it's challenging to receive a diagnosis for a child who you're watching and you're seeing some concerns for. And when a diagnosis does come in, what do you believe is necessary for parents to do? Or is there something specific to do once you get a diagnosis?
I think that there are a range of things that need to happen. And what I always love to share with families is to be comfortable and okay with grieving the idea that they are not raising a typically developing child and understand that that's okay. It's just gonna look different. And so one thing that I always remind families of is there is a grieving process and it's acceptable. And to look at moving through those five stages of grief that are just real. I'll briefly talk about them so that perhaps families can identify if they're in one of these spaces and learn how to move through them in order to be healthier as a family. The first stage is denial. And usually we see this in fathers, and that's usually just because they are not the primary caregiver. They're often less involved in the day-to-day than the mother. And because of that, you find kind of excuses and reasons why perhaps the child isn't speaking, or they're just quiet and they're like my brother. My brother's quiet, he's perfectly fine. And so usually that denial stage comes a bit more with fathers. Then there's anger that happens, and that's okay too. Why us? Why my child? Did I do something wrong? And this is a time when family tension is usually very high. Tension specifically between parents. Parents are often not communicating at this time adequately. And it's just something that has to be recognized as an issue so that you can move past it. Recognize it and move past it. The third one is bargaining. And that's probably the riskiest stage, I would say. Because in the bargaining stage is kind of when families are desperate to find that quick fix that's not real. And so what happens is oftentimes you'll find families, and this is usually the mom who's on the internet looking for other moms who said, oh, this cured my kid, or this doctor is the only doctor to go to, and this doctor doesn't take insurance, but that's the cure. And so that's kind of the space that you really want to recognize when you're in it. And that's the time to seek help, because there is no magic that's instantly going to cure anything. That's not real. So recognizing that, understanding that will help you move past that stage. The fourth stage is depression. And this is a stage that if families don't identify that they're in, they'll stay in for a long time. Feeling overwhelmed, feeling powerless, having don't understand, struggles just understanding how your child develops, struggles managing disruptive behaviors that you hadn't seen before, self-injurious behaviors, or severe tantrums, especially if you have other children. And those other children don't perhaps act in the same way. It can be extremely overwhelming for families. Many children have sleep disturbances, meaning they could wake up in the middle of the night. They don't sleep at night at all. And so parents have to be extremely vigilant during times when they need rest, but don't get it. And so they're often overwhelmed, exhausted, and have difficulty just functioning on their own, more or less taking care of their children. Parents also have to recognize at that time, this is definitely a time to get some assistance, because you can't move forward and function with your family if you're overwhelmed and in that depression stage. And then the fifth stage is acceptance. And this is a space where parents understand their child learns differently than other children, than typically developing children, it's okay. And that there's many treatments out there that will help them to be the best that they can be in life, and it's okay. And so it's important that families find their way through those stages, identify it, be okay with it, and move your way through them.
And how long would you say these stages can take? Like, what can a parent expect as far as being able to, once they recognize what they're up to and what kind of stage they're in, how long might it take for a parent to be able to move past and be able to come to a level of acceptance for their child?
I think that depends on the help that they get and the support system they have around them. And so sometimes there are many families, particularly in an area that I live in Atlanta, Georgia, where it's transient, and families don't often have family members around. And so they seek support groups. But what's most important is to seek a professional, a psychologist, a therapist that understands the space and can help you to move through these stages. And I think it will be a lot quicker if you have assistance in doing it. Just doing it on your own is not real. That's a very difficult feat, and everybody's going to be different. Nobody's going to be the same.
So it sounds to me like there are two angles here. One is a practical angle, right? Get help so you can manage, get enough sleep so that you can deal with things properly, get enough respite or support for your child or other children so you can actually function day-to-day life and manage your responsibilities. And then there's a second angle where emotionally you might need to tap into a therapist or a professional to help you move past the stages that are just normal as far as the grieving process when somebody realizes that their child is not typically developing. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And sometimes people think that they're dealing with things well because they're used to dealing with things on their own. But sometimes it's just good just to seek that additional assistance, just in case you might need a little help.
So being open to the fact that even though you're a good coper and you're pretty much in a good place, you might want to tap into somebody who can just be that extra support for you, whether you need it now or in the future.
Absolutely.
And what would you say that families can begin to do to create a healthy family environment, right? Everybody wants their family to grow and develop in a healthy, nurturing way. And sometimes having a child with special needs or a specific diagnosis or disability can interfere with your ideas of how that might look. So how would you say a parent should approach that as far as the relationships that they have with their children, with their spouse, and in general, creating that healthy family environment that we dream of?
I think first, I always love to suggest family therapy. At diagnoses, to make sure everybody's on the same page, because oftentimes mom and dad are not on the same page about this and aren't effectively communicating that to each other and have different expectations. And so a good family therapist can help them move into a space where they're on the same page, they're comfortable talking with each other, even when they disagree with each other specifically about their child and their care, they can do it in a way that's effective and healthy, as opposed to angry and frustrated. And that's often what happens in this space, is it's anger and frustrated because there's so many unknowns, so many variables, and so many things that are uncontrollable by the family. Making sure that you seek the help recommended by the person that diagnosed your child. Don't sit on it too long. Don't sit on it. Don't sit back. Wait for this to go away. Take prompt action on that. It's important to follow what instructions you've been given. It's also important to attend to other family members. And what I mean by that is include other family members. If grandparents live with you, they have to understand what's going on. They cannot be separate from treatment, because what will happen is they'll be doing something very different than what you've been directed to do by whoever's leading treatment for your family. If there are other siblings, it's important not to exclude those siblings. It is essential that they are a part of treatment. And what I mean by that is the family therapy. Oftentimes, the siblings feel excluded, feel alone. They're not getting all the attention. And so making sure that you find ways to have special time for the siblings, make sure that they have a proper time to communicate. And it's okay for them to communicate their frustrations or their feelings about their sibling. It has to be okay. And sometimes they may need their own therapist just to deal with it themselves. What I've seen that's really worked well, and a lot of communities are growing to have this, are sibling support groups of all ages. And that really allows for an opportunity for them to understand their sibling, to be supportive of their sibling, but also to have their own space. That's been very important for siblings to have also good relationships with their other sibling that's on the spectrum.
Wow. So really what's primary is, yeah. So it sounds to me like, yeah, it sounds to me like focus on the relationships, right? Make sure that everybody's on the same page. Everybody has a space to develop their own, I guess you could say, coping mechanism and way of dealing with the new reality. Making sure that everybody gets the attention and that, I guess, support, right? For
absolutely
coping with all this new information. And I see why you're saying that even if you're a good coper, you might need somebody to tap into yourself, because as a parent, you end up being that, you need to be the rock, right, for everybody else, but sometimes you need somebody to rely on as well, right? So
absolutely.
You're holding 100%. Down the fort, you're being available for everybody's emotional reactions, for everybody's, you know, way of dealing with it, which might not be as, you know, simple as it sounds here, but, you know, sometimes you need to tap into other supports that will give you the emotional strength to be able to be that rock for everybody else, including definitely grandparents and children. So there's always those different dynamics and, you know, the old school way of thinking on how to deal with a kid and, you know, how that kind of doesn't always merge with the reality of the child's behaviors and things that might look embarrassing or be uncomfortable in a community setting or in a group family setting. I'm just curious, as far as what parents typically do from your experience, what do you find to be a common error or mistake that parents will do? Maybe because of that rash emotional state after they get a diagnosis, like that desperation of, I guess, denial, this can't be true, right? So what have you seen that parents will go to as an initial reaction, and what can parents do about that in advance to help guide them and steer them to a better path?
I'm going to answer this by sharing a story with you. I think I shared with you before that I started out as what would be now called a registered behavior technician. Okay. And I worked with a family very early in the diagnosis. And so I think he had been diagnosed maybe 3 months before I started with him. And I watched the mom go through some of these things that I'm going to share with you. And one of them that she did was look for those instant cures. Look for those instant cures that people are talking about. And I will never forget. And it was, I believe, 1998. I'm dating myself. But I'm pretty sure it was 1998. Pretty sure. The big thing was secretin. And secretin was supposed to be the cure-all. Because one mom said that her child started talking after he had this gastrointestinal hormone. And so families were mortgaging their homes to get these, to get secretin. And that's what they did. I watched it happen. It did absolutely nothing. There is zero research that suggests it does anything. But that's was the big thing. A mom said it worked. And so that's what happened. And so not jumping on some of those instant cures, because that's not real. There are no instant cures. So that's a mistake that families often make, is looking for that instant cure. Incessantly searching on the internet for that one magical thing. Just because they're still in the denial stage and they're desperately looking for something. That is a huge mistake. Because there are treatments out there that will change your child's life, but it's not going to be instant ever. Excluding important family members from treatment, as I shared before, that's a huge mistake, especially if you have family members that live with you. Oftentimes there are grandparents or uncles or aunts or cousins or whoever that live with the family. Excluding them from treatment, especially if you're doing ABA, will not work well for the family. As you shared, often there's the old school way of doing things. And when there's a maladaptive behavior or a quote unquote tantrum, that means different things to different people, depending on your age group. And I experienced a family that was in my office, and it was the grandparents and the parents, and they wanted to spank the child because he was having a tantrum. Well, we talked about it, obviously. Can't spank him in my office. That's not what we're doing. But he was having a tantrum because he was having a reaction to something. And so I had everybody stop and look at what, there's something different. I identified it very quickly. But what it was grandma had on perfume. And every time he got close to grandma, he was breaking out in hives. He was turning red and he would start screaming and throwing things and yelling. So I asked grandma to walk out the room. Here's why. So we don't know what the problem is, and helping grandparents and other family members also understand that you don't know why this is happening. It could be simply, my child can't communicate like your child did, or like my other children do. And so this is how he expresses. We just have to teach him a different way. That's all. So just really making sure that you include these other family members so we don't have situations in which the child can't move into where they need to move, just because we have too many different mixed messages that are completely confusing the child and aren't good for him, to be quite honest.
Can I interject for a second?
Sure.
I heard of a story where there was a child who had a significant diagnosis, a genetic diagnosis that wasn't identified at birth, and it typically is. It could be it was a milder form, and therefore it didn't come out until maybe 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 3 months after the child was born, after everybody celebrated and saw the child and held the child and everybody was so excited. And the parents obviously were devastated, but they weren't sure how to navigate letting family members know that their child now has a diagnosis that isn't obvious, right? So it wasn't at a stage where the child was lacking tremendously in development, right? Those early months, it's kind of hard to know unless the genetic piece is identified, you know, through different means. But at that point, they really struggled. They didn't know what to do. They did not end up sharing the diagnosis, and they really got caught in their own web because eventually they were trying to cover for things that were starting to become more noticeable. Right. And then at which point do you tell grandma that her beautiful granddaughter has a big problem? Right. So that, you know, it almost doesn't make it easier to push it off. It makes it easier just to come out clean and just let everybody know when you know, so that everybody, you know, the grandparents also have some kind of grieving stage, right? Here we waited for our grandchild for so long, and our grandchild is not perfect. So I just wanted to mention that you jogged this memory of mine. And I remember thinking how sad it is, because at which point are the parents going to have the strength to own up to what's really going on?
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And I think that's when having that assistance from a professional, a psychologist, a therapist, to assist them in that communication can really change things for families and make it easier, help them to deal with it, help them to get over the guilt or frustrations or angst even about what may be said because their child has now this diagnosis. That's a really good point.
And I think there's another point that sometimes comes up. Sometimes there isn't a diagnosis until the child is 10 or 11, and particularly with girls, because the presentation is so different in ASD with girls and with boys. So sometimes at that point, it dawns on the parent that there's a younger sibling, just as an example, who is showing more intense signs of autism. Parent goes and gets a diagnosis. And as a parent is kind of dealing with that reality, they realize that their 10-year-old might very well fit the bill, right? Difficulty with social, certain awkwardness. And because it presents so differently, right? Then there's like a dual issue where you need to cope with the 3-year-old who is nonverbal or, you know, looks or seems to be uncontrollable because we aren't dealing with it with that proper lens, right? And then realizing that the older sibling, like, oh my goodness, how am I dealing with this, right? It's so overwhelming. Right. What would you say as far as that kind of scenario?
Well, you know, that situation is so common. And I'm so glad that you brought it up because it happens very often. It's happened in my own family where when I met my husband, I think I shared this with you. His oldest child I met first, and he was very clearly on the spectrum to me because I've been doing this forever. Right. However, to other people, they just thought he was a little bit quirky and he was having a lot of problems because he doesn't pay close attention to things. And there were so many different excuses. But then when I met some of the other family members that were clearly on the spectrum and everybody knew that, I said, well, wait a minute, This is why this is happening. Let's talk about it. Let's address this situation and then we won't have these issues anymore. And so really understanding that this can happen. Oh, I'm so sorry. This can happen. And families have to look at all aspects of their own dynamics that may create issues that they don't know that they're even creating themselves. And, you know, and I think also sometimes families get so caught up because they are so overwhelmed and don't know that they're overwhelmed because they're doing so much and so used to doing so much that they don't notice these things. And, you know, it's okay. Let's identify it and let's move on. Let's figure out how to make the best of what we have.
Wow. Another point that I'm thinking now, I've worked in the school system a couple of years, first in the public school, then in a private school. And I found that particularly parents, I mean, given the framework that you just recommend that you went through as far as the grieving process, right? So I'm assuming there are parents who are very strongly either in denial or bargaining and trying to find that magical cure and really not at the point of acceptance. I found that very often the parents relied on the school system to provide the kind of resources that I'm just not sure the school system can provide, right? So how would you say a parent should view the services provided by a school compared to what they might need for practical functioning at home?
I'm glad you brought that up. The school system has to provide, it's not their choice, they have to provide education and certain services in order to allow for an appropriate education for a child diagnosed on the spectrum. And they usually include OT, PT, speech, sometimes even ABA, but it cannot, because the resources are not there, it cannot be the quality, it cannot be the length of time needed in order to really move your child into a space where they are going to be at their best. And so when a diagnosis happens and let's say the psychologist suggests ABA, occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech pathology, it might be that they are receiving all of those services in school. But when you compare, let's say 30 minutes or an hour a day, three times a week, privately paid by insurance, as opposed to 30 minutes of group a week by the school system, you can see that you cannot get what's needed for your child in that way. They cannot be as successful as they could be. Oftentimes, there is a BCBA or maybe two for the school system, the entire school system. There is absolutely no way that one BCBA for the entire school system can serve your child. That's not real, ever. And so making sure that you understand that the frequency and duration are just not going to be adequate to truly affect change, and that those services must be sought out outside of the school system. They are not there to treat your child. They're there to educate your child. And that means something very different than treatment. With that, really knowing that you are your child's best advocate. You know your child better than anybody. You are the expert on your child. You are the child's best advocate. And with that, just really knowing what the law is important, because what I found, and this is not everywhere, it truly is not. This is not all school districts or systems, but often they just do the bare minimum because they don't have the resources, not because they don't want to do more for your child, but they don't have the resources to possibly give your child what's necessary. And so sometimes they cut corners because they have to, because they've been put in a position to. And so knowing what your child's rights are decreases the cuts. So knowing that they're mandated to offer speech therapy and that once a week is not going to cut it in a group for 30 minutes and fighting for more, it's going to be an uphill battle, but it's worth it because then they'll get it there. And then they'll also get what they need privately with your insurance. Medicaid is paying a lot more for things for our children diagnosed on the spectrum now. Private insurance, not so much, but it's very different than what you'll get from the school system. So understanding what all of the different laws are, I don't want to go through every single one of them, but understanding IDEA, and you can certainly look them up. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act is important to know. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's important to know, just so you know what your rights are, what your child's rights are, and you have an expectation. And attending every single IEP, and sometimes what I've always shared with families, you can call an IEP meeting. You can say, this is not working for my child, and I need to see something different. And call an IEP meeting yourself. You don't have to wait until another 6 months of things not working for your child, or the education not working in any way for your child, because the next IEP meeting is in 6 months or in a year. You can call it in 2 months. You can call it in 3 weeks. whatever is necessary in order to get your child exactly what they need, you're in charge of that. So that's one of the things that I really want to make sure families understand is you do have some control there. You do have some control, and it's important that your voice is heard. And when your voice is heard, if nothing else, they don't want to be bothered with you too much. So they'd rather give you what you need and rather get your child as much as they can possibly offer you than you call the school all the time. That's just the truth.
Right. At the end of the day, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So when you're very actively involved, they know that, right?
Absolutely.
Something that they pick up on. And I'm happy that you spoke about the school piece, because my experience working in a school as a clinician is that I've had, you know, conversations with mothers where they have a lot of concerns for at home, and they're kind of wondering why, if their child is making progress in school and everything sounds beautiful and the teachers are looking at things with rose-colored glasses, why they're struggling so much at home. And I remember telling them that at the end of the day, you need to realize that there are a tremendous amount of resources in a school. So the same effort, time, energy that went into working with your child to get your child into a good place, right? With a rhythm and a routine and a system and, you know, reinforcement and the whole gamut of what goes into providing a good quality program, you kind of need to invest the same time and energy at home to create that, because it doesn't exist yet, right? And that's really where my passions lie, because when I started Mastermind, I realized this is a huge, huge area that is, we really need to create that link, right? To make sure that the home is as solid as can be and that parents feel empowered in their own homes, right? With the right kind of training, the right kind of support, being able to watch the progress happening without having to intervene just yet, so that you can feel comfortable and see that it really works. See that your child can do well. See that your child's behaviors can be maintained in this setting. And then you know that you can transplant that right into another area with other people. Your child can learn to generalize that across settings. You can get to a place of comfort where you can take your child to a holiday party. You can take your child out in the community and know that they're going to stay dry, right? And not have an accident. Know that they're not going to be running up and down the escalators with you trying to get them off, right? And it's challenging, it's hard, and it's sometimes embarrassing, and you don't want that to happen. So with the right kind of support at home, it kind of takes away that anxiety and that pressure for the parent to help them come to a place of acceptance. So I so appreciate that distinction between the school and the home, right? It's important to realize.
Absolutely. And something that I love that you do is parent training. You can do ABA all day long, but if the parents aren't trained in what you're doing and they're not there to watch and observe how you're doing it, and if they're not there to really watch it not work at first and then watch it blossom into something beautiful, that then there's buy-in, and then that parent understands, oh, okay, this is how you do it. And they have that confidence in, like you said, taking them to Target. You know, we can go to Target without a tantrum, or you know, any place, and being around family. And so that's something that all ABA entities do not do. They're supposed to, but do not require it. And that is a failure for the family and for the child. And so I do appreciate how your team works to make sure that the family has what they need and can ensure that things will transfer to them and transfer to the grandparents or whoever else is around that child, and then their success.
One last question. So before we wrap up and open up the floor to questions if people have, what would you say or recommend as common forms of treatment, and how can a parent recognize what's a valuable treatment compared to a cure, right? Like, how do we come up with that distinction? There's so much going on the internet. If you're looking for support and you type in autism support, you'll get a lot of interesting things coming up. So how can a parent sort through and make the best decisions for their child as far as treatment goes?
Absolutely. First thing is, if a child's diagnosed on the spectrum, it is 99.9% of the time that they will be an ABA recommendation. That they will, the recommendation to do applied behavior analysis will be there. Something families sometimes don't understand and struggle with is that it is time intensive. It's a lot. It takes a lot of your time, but that's what changes their world and your world. Some families, I've had families say, well, I'm only available twice a week for an hour. Well, that's not ABA. I can't do that. I'm not going to waste your time or mine. We're not doing that. It is intensive. It's a lot. I say that a million times because families sometimes don't get it because they've been doing speech and speech is only an hour twice a week. That's not ABA. So the number one life changer is ABA. All the research shows it. Every good doctor will recommend that. Also there's speech, there's occupational therapy, there's physical therapy. Those are all things that are going to enhance your children's skills, but ABA is what's going to change their world. I often recommend allergy testing, especially for nonverbal children, for such as the story that I told you about with the child and the grandmother with the perfume. I had a situation when I was first learning and I was, you know, 20, where I changed laundry detergents because my parents weren't doing my laundry anymore. Okay. And I had the cheap stuff and I walked in the room and I was attacked. The child I was working with instantly attacked me, became red, had rash just everywhere. And I had no idea what was going on because I just walked in and I knew I was his favorite. So I didn't understand what was happening at all. But that's what it was. He was allergic to my new fabric softener. And so I've seen it so many times where it's things that people don't often think of. So I always recommend allergy testing just to check. I also recommend a developmental pediatrician. Sometimes, this is not all pediatricians, but sometimes pediatricians don't quite understand autism and sometimes lead families in a direction that is not in support of ABA. And it can oftentimes be dysfunctional. And so I typically, if there is a developmental pediatrician around, because there's not a lot in the country, but to utilize that developmental pediatrician because he's going to help you to, or she is going to help you to understand your child better and look at those developmental milestones in a different way than a pediatrician who is not. So those are the kind of basic, most common treatments that will help to move your child into a space that's healthier for them and for everyone around them.
Wow. So I think that really covers so many important aspects of dealing with the diagnosis from the beginning of those stages, right? All the way until practical ways of helping your child, finding the right kinds of supports, knowing what to do with your rights in the school system and how to leverage that to get the best that you can for your child, how to access the kinds of support at home through private insurance, through Medicaid, things that are covered, things that are research-based and proven to have good results as opposed to looking for a cure. So I so appreciate your presentation. And I really hope that this has been helpful for the parents who are able to join today. I just want to open up the floor if anyone has any questions that they want to ask about the content. If you don't feel comfortable, that's fine. That's understandable. We're not looking to put anyone in a position where it will be uncomfortable to share. But if you are able to share or ask questions or comments, there are definitely other parents who might benefit from the same questions that you have.
I'm just curious, what's the difference between a regular pediatrician and a developmental pediatrician?
So a developmental pediatrician has extended time in specifically working with children diagnosed on the spectrum. And so their space is development.
And so specific to kids on the spectrum?
Yes, so they're looking, and other varying developmental disabilities. So they're specific to developmental disabilities. And so
they're identifying. Are you saying extra time means extra schooling or their experience or internship has been in that field?
Yes, they're so they don't go, they go for developmental pediatrician is different than just a pediatrics.
Okay, thanks for clarifying.
So their residency is different.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
And does that mean that they give more time and attention to the patient when they come? Do they help the parents
Absolutely.
With the resources? Like, how does that differ yes. from going to your pediatrician and saying, I have a concern?
Sure. So my experience with developmental pediatricians is this is not an in and out 5-minute situation when we go to see the pediatrician. This is sometimes 45 minutes. This is sometimes an hour where they spend to really take the time to really understand and ask questions in a different way than a typical pediatrician would, because their understanding of development is different, particularly in regards to autism.
So a parent might have a pediatrician where they might go for a sore throat, and then a developmental pediatrician where they check up on the child's development. It's not one thing that takes over the other, right? It's,
correct.
It's
correct.
An additional resource, an additional doctor who's looking at
Absolutely.
Development and health.
Oh, and, wow. and typically that developmental pediatrician also likes to and wants to interact with all of the other resources. And so that's something that I typically do is work with the developmental pediatrician. They want the assessment reports that come from the ABA centers. They want the speech path reports. They want the OT, the PT. They want all the reports because they want to really have a different understanding, and they're going to read it. And then when you go back, they're going to understand the space that your child's in a very different way that might happen in your regular pediatrician's office.
Okay, so it's more comprehensive, right? They're trying to get all the pieces together, not just looking at the actual health of the child. They're looking at all different forms of development and how they might play themselves out in different areas.
Absolutely.
Wow. That sounds like a great option, right? To add that to a list of resources for parents.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you so much for your presentation. We really appreciate your knowledge, your insight, your background, your expertise, and sharing that with parents who are able to join today.
I'm so glad that you gave me the opportunity.
Okay, have a wonderful day.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.